This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm D.A. Yusuf in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Be honest to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders.
That was UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet calling for an immediate end to the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region and for access to independent investigators. Details coming up. Also, in a couple of weeks, a court could decide whether South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, goes to jail or not. And three opposition candidates in Chad quit the race for the presidency. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Africa's Constitutional Court will decide in about 3 weeks whether former President Jacob Zuma goes to jail or not. Zuma is accused of treating the court with contempt by refusing to comply with its order to testify at the Commission of Inquiry into Corruption. The inquiry has heard evidence that Zuma appointed cronies to plunder state enterprises of billions of rands when he led South Africa from 2009 to 2018. Darren Taylor reports.
The commission headed by Judge Raymond Zondo wants the court to jail Zuma for 2 years. Sources close to the former president tell VOA he's strongly considering not even sending lawyers to argue his case.
If Zuma just doesn't pitch, then the court has to make up its mind without his help.
That was Kathy Powell, a law professor at the University of Cape Town. She says this wouldn't be the first time Zuma hasn't bothered to defend himself.
It's interesting that last time the court made up its mind without his help, he immediately accused the court of bias, and he accused the court of being politicized. One of the things he kept saying was...
Even when Zuma was president, say legal commentators, he acted as if laws didn't apply to him and his allies.
If he carries on like he's been doing so far, he won't turn up. The Constitutional Court will reach a decision without him. I cannot see anything other than a conviction for contempt of court because the facts are too obvious. So the question just becomes what kind of sentence the court's going to impose. And if it does impose a sentence of imprisonment, then he will be arrested and imprisoned immediately.
Powell says Zuma clearly thinks the court won't dare to jail an important political figure like him and will instead impose a fine. But she adds that the former ANC leader seems to be craving prosecution.
It is possible that Zuma is not actually interested in what the court thinks of him, but is playing to some different audience. And if the court makes a more adversarial finding against him, which it's likely to do if it hasn't heard his argument, then he's got more of a ground to complain that he's a victim of some conspiracy.
Independent political analyst Kolani Dube believes Zuma succeeded in turning the commission into a political farce.
I think what is happening in the Zondo Commission is an arena where people who were not seeing eye to eye previously, they are using now this noble forum to discredit each other. We always ask ourselves as the citizen, if that Zondo Commission really is there to mine the truth, or is it there to further the differences of those who were at each other's throat previously? Because, to be quite honest,
Dube says it's clear that the commission represents the interests of Zuma's sworn political foe, Cyril Ramaphosa, who replaced him as president. He says Zuma's encouraged this scenario from the beginning of the inquiry.
I think the former president, Jacob Zuma, he sensed that, look, this has nothing to do about justice, but it is a political game. And now he is playing a political game. All of us, we know very well that he's good at it. And that is pushing Ubaba Uzondo into a corner because he's not a political guru and he's not even political savvy. And so he is in trouble. And now the whole commission starting to unravel, to say it was nothing to do with justice.
Political and legal observers say whatever happens to Zuma will be a pivotal point in the constitutional history of democratic South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization reports it is employing every measure in its toolbox to curb the spread of parallel Ebola outbreaks in Guinea and the Democratic Republic of Congo to prevent this deadly virus from getting out of hand. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
One of the biggest lessons learned from the 2014-2016 Ebola epidemic in West Africa, the largest in history, is the critical importance of acting quickly to contain the deadly disease. World health officials began marshaling staff and working on a strategy to combat the disease as soon as the first cases of the deadly Ebola virus were detected in Guinea on February 14th. A rapid assessment conducted by the WHO in the country and in the region found the risk level to be very high. WHO representative in Guinea, George Alfred Kizerbo, says the WHO and partners have been stepping up efforts to implement Guinea's strategic response plan. That, he says, involves increased surveillance on the ground, accelerating preparedness measures in neighboring countries, and working closely with communities to interrupt the outbreak as soon as possible.
In doing so, we are engaging traditional leaders, including also traditional practitioners, and we are going to families and communities to discuss with them, to listen to them, and see what are the understanding of the disease, what is the fears of the preoccupations of the community, so that we can increase the success of our interventions.
To date, the WHO reports 18 cases of Ebola in Guinea, including 4 deaths. Kizerbo says health workers have traced hundreds of people who have come in contact with infected people. He says more than 1,600 people so far have been vaccinated against the virus, including high-risk contacts and health workers. Meanwhile, North Kivu province in the eastern DRC is experiencing its own fresh Ebola outbreak. Since February 7th, the WHO reports there have been 11 cases and 4 deaths. Another Ebola outbreak in eastern Congo ended just last June. WHO Director of Strategic Health Operations Michelle Yao says dealing with both the COVID-19 and Ebola epidemics is quite a challenge, especially in countries with fragile health systems.
There are some similar approach, at least in some of the components like community sensitization, as well as preventive measures that have to be implemented. Vaccination is maybe less challenging because it's different areas. And I think the approach in most of the countries for COVID, they will probably start with health workers.
WHO health officials agree it will likely be difficult to get the funding needed to stem the twin Ebola outbreaks. Besides appealing to government donors, they say they also will tap leading financial institutions such as the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the U.S. Agency for International Development. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Joe Biden says he will conduct a value-based foreign policy in the next 4 years in the Middle and North Africa. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that will focus on encouraging key reforms, overturning bad laws, fighting corruption, stopping unjust practices, and incentivizing democratic behavior. Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what a values-oriented foreign policy would look like regarding Arab countries that are close to the U.S. but have had bad human rights records.
The answer is quite clear, and the answer is clear both from the perspective of human rights law, so it's not just about our values, it's actually the law, but also from the perspective of what is actually in America's interest and what is actually in the interest of the peoples of the region. And to that end, I think the most important change that we need to see if we are to have a values-based policy, if we are to have a smart foreign policy that truly reflects America's interests, then we would stop providing military assistance and diplomatic protection to the abusive governments of the region. That it's very important to distinguish between what some people talk about, which is that the United States should fix everything that's wrong in the Middle East, should intervene to stop abusive governments from carrying out their abuses. I would advocate a much more humble approach, which is that the United States should simply stop providing military assistance and diplomatic protection to the abusive governments of the region.
What are the barriers to the U.S. taking a stronger approach to demanding democracy in Egypt when close strategic cooperation with the U.S. is in the balance?
I think that that is a false dichotomy that we see even very smart commentators often present. You know, that on the one hand, there's strategic cooperation and security interests, and on the other hand, there's human rights. And I think that's very wrong. Ending U.S. military support to Egypt, a dictatorship that is highly abusive, highly repressive, and highly dangerous, does not mean ending security cooperation with Egypt. Saying that we're not going to give them gifts of weapons doesn't mean that we're going to end all relationships with them. There may well be strategic counterterrorism cooperation, for example, that is in the interests of America and is in the interests of Egypt, and that we might continue. That is a very different proposition from providing over $1 billion in military aid to this abusive government. That goes far beyond any kind of strategic cooperation.
How could the formation of Egypt Human Rights Caucus in the U.S. Congress help advance this cause when Egypt enjoys geostrategic advantage coupled with close security cooperation with the U.S.?
Well, I think the main way that it's going to be helpful, and we are going to be part of that effort, and we're very eager to see it move forward, is that we are going to force the U.S. Congress and force the Biden administration to reevaluate what interest exactly the military aid to Egypt provides, what exactly it serves. And I think it will help the American public and the American government to more clearly see how the Egyptian government's repression and abuse of its own citizens harms America's interests and violates its own human rights obligations not to assist in human rights abuses. Because when the United States provides military support to this abusive government, it is also committing rights abuses itself. I think that the new committee will help draw attention to those unjustly persecuted in Egypt, to the journalists, to the lawyers, to the former political leaders who are rotting away in jail in unprecedented numbers, facing brutal torture, systematic, widespread torture. And I hope wake up the Biden administration to really pause and question, why are we helping this government? Why are we helping a government that is making the country a more dangerous place, a more unstable place, than a better one?
That was Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi. Saying the climate isn't favorable for fair and transparent elections, three opposition candidates in Chad yesterday quit the race for the presidency. The French news agency AFP says their pullout still leaves half a dozen candidates, including incumbent Idriss Deby, who has ruled for the last 30 years and is widely deemed a shoo-in for a sixth term. One of the candidates who withdrew, leading opposition figure Saleh Kabzabo, describes the current political climate in Chad as militarized. His remarks came after police and troops raided the home of another fellow contender, Yaya Dilo Dejiru. The UN, France, and international rights groups have called for an inquiry into the raid. Yaya Dilo's party says five of his family members have been killed. The government has acknowledged the death of his mother and two soldiers. The most prominent challenger still in the race is Nayabi Romdumangar, officially the opposition leader. Uganda is set to start vaccinations for COVID-19 after getting a shipment from the COVAX facility that is supplying a number of countries. And as reporter Mugume Davis Rawakaringi reports from Kampala, Some residents say they will not get an injection, with some fearing it could adversely affect their lives.
Kampala resident Mujisha Alshaza says he will not take a jab because the vaccines have not had the test of time. He says he fears a long impact on his health.
Not that I wouldn't take it for the greater good, but I don't think I'm conversant with putting my life on the line for something that they're not sure of. And if it's like how we grew up taking medication, they tell you this one will work, this one will not work.
Nakato Amina also says she'll monitor how the vaccine affects others.
Me, I would not take the vaccine. I don't trust it, though some can trust it, but I can't. Others can take, me, I can't.
At least 40,000 plus people have tested positive for COVID-19 in Uganda, leading to 334 deaths, according to the Ministry of Health. It says the government wants to have at least 45 million doses of the vaccine and an additional 22 million doses for refugees. The first batch of 864,000 of AstraZeneca will arrive today, Friday, with vaccinations start by the end of next week. Another Kampala resident, Emmanuel Abamile, says the government should sensitize the population on the possible side effects of the vaccine.
Let it be once. It will work on us. The government give us, it will work on us. Because why is it coming that we have to sign? It will bring side effects. It is the government also doubting whether it will work, it will not work. Because we believe that he have approved the, what he is going to give us.
Health Minister Ruth Jane Acheng says the government is doing what can to ensure the vaccine is safe.
We are using a software to enter the names of the persons and the dose that is given. Hence the requirement for a national ID, so that we can account for all the doses.
Utaji Stephen says he's ready to be inoculated.
I believe they should be safe. There are so many people who are checking for it. So you cannot have misgivings that probably it's dangerous to your health or something like that. If there's that opportunity to be vaccinated, I believe it should be very safe for us.
The government has said it has procured vaccines mainly from India and China. Officials say they vaccinate at least 21 million Ugandans, or some 49% of the population, starting with the most vulnerable people and essential workers who are at risk, such as health officials, reporters and teachers. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
Both the United States and the United Nations are calling for an immediate end to the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region and for access to independent investigators amid reports of ongoing atrocities against civilians. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Ethiopian federal troops deployed by Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed have been fighting forces of the region's former ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Thousands of people have been killed in the Tigray region, where hundreds of thousands were dependent on food aid before the conflict began, according to the UN. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet stressed the urgent need for an objective investigation on the ground in Tigray, citing distressing reports of sexual and gender-based violence, extrajudicial killings, and lootings. The new U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, agrees.
The onus to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders. We urge the Ethiopian government to support an immediate end to the fighting in Tigray. And to that end, the prompt withdrawal of Eritrean forces and Amhara regional forces from Tigray are essential steps.
In a recent phone conversation with Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated U.S. commitment to providing humanitarian assistance to the vulnerable in the country. Abiy made commitments to ensure security in the region and protect civilians, according to State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
I think what we're going to look to are both the right words, but of course, even more importantly, the follow-through.
Amnesty International has concluded that Eritrean soldiers killed hundreds of civilians in Ethiopia's ancient town of Aksum in November. Stopping the ongoing fighting and getting independent investigators into the area will require an international effort, experts tell VOA. Adote Akwe of Amnesty International USA.
This is clearly going to take a UN Security Council type weight of diplomacy and political pressure to try to change Prime Minister Abiy's approach to both what is going on inside the country, but also to longer and badly needed reforms.
Akwe and other experts note that Ethiopia is a strategic U.S. military ally in the Horn of Africa, and in recent years has been viewed as a stable partner in a troubled region. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Burkina Faso's opposition has stepped up pressure on President Roch Kabore to follow through on a one-time campaign promise to allow former President Blaise Compaoré to return from exile. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
It's been 7 years since Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré fled his compound to Ivory Coast after a popular uprising against his attempt to extend his nearly three decades in power. But his Congress for Democracy and Progress, or CDP party, says their finishing second in November's election shows support for Compaoré and his return are growing. Amaru Sawadogo, one of more than a million displaced Burkinabes, was driven out of his home by terrorists 2 years ago and says life was better under Compaoré. He says that when Compaoré was in charge, his community never experienced insecurity. For that reason, they believe Compaoré's way of ruling worked and his return could help improve security. Compaoré made neutrality deals with the jihadist groups in Mali in return for security at home, deals that were later scrapped. He committed Burkina Faso to the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Mali, MINUSMA, and was still in power when their troops were for the first time attacked. Nonetheless, Compaoré's party says negotiations with armed groups need to be revived, and he's the one to do it. Reason commands us to do it, says Eddie Kamwego, the leader of the CDP and Compaoré's political heir. He points out the country has been attacked for 5 years by unidentified groups and suggests the first reaction should be to find out who is attacking you and why. President Roch Kabore's government last month, for the first time, raised the option of holding direct talks with terrorist groups in parliament. But since then, it has become clear negotiations with armed groups have already commenced in the area around the city of Djibo. Despite a campaign speech that promised Compaoré's return, Kabore's ruling People's Movement for Progress party, MPP, says it is not guaranteed. But they say he had better relations with jihadists. Lassane Samadogo is the executive secretary of the MPP and says his party has refrained from making direct accusations against anyone with regard to the phenomenon of terrorism. However, they have observed very good relations between certain terrorist groups attacking the country and the old regime, he adds. Analysts and officials say Compaoré's return could help Burkina Faso's political reconciliation, but are sceptical about the impact he could have on improving security. Siaka Koulibaly is a Burkinabe security analyst. He explains that providing advice to today's political leader will put Compaoré in a very different position to address the issue in comparison to when he was in charge of the country's affairs himself. He thinks Compaoré can make a universal contribution in terms of political advice, but, in reality, is not sure he can reverse the trend of violence. With the scars of his ouster still visible, allowing Compaoré to return to Burkina Faso could reopen old wounds. Officials say he would also have to face justice for the violent 1987 coup that brought him to power. That could be enough of a threat to keep the former president's house empty. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.